Chapter 11. Domovoy. After Sasha and Olga went away, Dunya noticed a change in Vasya. For one thing, she disappeared more than ever. For another, she talked much less. And sometimes, when she did talk, folk were startled. The girl was growing too big for childish babble, and yet...
Dunya, Vasya asked one day, not long after Olga's wedding, when the heat lay like a hand over the woods and fields. What lives in the river?
She was drinking sap. She took a great draught, eyed her nurse expectantly.
Fish, Vasochka. And if you will only behave yourself until tomorrow, we shall have some caught fresh with new herbs and cream.
Vasya loved fish, but she shook her head.
No, Dunya, what else lives in the river? Something with eyes like a frog and hair like waterweed and mud dripping down its nose.
Dunya shot the child a sharp glance, but Vasya was occupied with the last bits of cabbage in the bottom of her bowl and did not see.
Have you been listening to peasant stories, Vasya? Asked Dunya.
That is the Vodyanoy, the river king, who is always looking for little maidens to take to his castle under the riverbank.
Vasya was scraping the bottom of her bowl with a distracted air.
Not the castle, she said, licking broth off her fingers. Just a hole in the riverbank. But I never knew what he was called before.
Vasya, began Dunya, looking into the child's bright eyes.
Said
Vasya, putting down her empty bowl and clambering to her feet. It was on the tip of Dunya's tongue to warn her explicitly against... what? Talking of fairy tales? Dunya bit the words back and thrust a cloth-covered basket at Vasya.
Here, said Dunya, take this to Father Semyon. He's been ill.
Vasya nodded. The priest's room was part of the house, but it could be entered through a separate door on the south wall. She seized a dumpling, stuffed it into her mouth before Dunya could object, and slipped out of the kitchen, humming loud and off-key, as her father was once wont to do. Slowly, as though against her will, Dunya's hand plunged into a pocket sewn inside her skirt. The star around the blue jewel gleamed, perfect as a snowflake, and the stone was icy cold to her touch, though she had labored over the oven all that sweltering morning.
Not yet, she whispered. She's still a little girl. Oh, please, not yet.
The gem lay gleaming against her withered palm. Dunya thrust it angrily back into her pocket and turned to stir the soup with a vindictiveness most unlike her, so that the clear broth sloshed over the sides and hissed on the oven's hot stones. Some time later, Kolya saw his sister peering out from a clump of tall grass. He pursed his lips. No one in 10 villages, he was sure, could contrive to be always underfoot as Vasya was.
Shouldn't you be in the kitchen, Vasya? He asked, an edge to his voice.
The day was hot, his sweating wife irritable. His newborn son was teething and shrieked without pause. At last Kolya, gritting his teeth, had snatched line and basket and made for the river. But now here was his sister come to trouble his peace. Vasya poked her head further out of the weeds, but did not quite leave her hiding place.
I could not help it, brother, she said coaxingly. Anna Ivanovna and Dunya were screeching at each other, and Irina was crying again.
Irina was her new baby half-sister, born a little before Kolya's own son.
I can't sew when Anna Ivanovna's about anyway. I forget how.
Kolya snorted. Vasya shifted in her hiding place.
Can I help you fish? She asked, hopefully.
No.
Can I watch you fish?
Kolya opened his mouth to refuse and then reconsidered. If she was sitting on the riverbank, she wouldn't be getting in trouble somewhere else.
Very well, he said, if you sit over there, quietly. Don't cast your shadow over the water.
Vasya crept meekly to the indicated spot. Kolya paid her no more attention, concentrating on the water and the feel of the line in his fingers. An hour later, Vasya was still sitting as instructed, and Kolya had 6 fine fish in his basket. Perhaps his wife would forgive his disappearance, he thought, glancing at his sister and wondering how she'd managed to sit still for so long. She was looking at the water with a rapt expression that made him uneasy. What was she seeing to make her stare so? The water whispered over its bed as it always had, beds of cress swaying in the current on either bank. There came a sharp tug on his line, and he forgot Vasya as he drew it in. But before the fish cleared the bank, the wooden hook snapped. Kolya swore. He coiled his line impatiently and replaced the hook. Preparing to cast again, he looked around. His basket was no longer in its place. He swore again louder and looked at Vasya. But she was sitting on a rock 10 paces away. "What happened?" she asked. "My fish are gone. Some durak from the village must have come and..." But Vasya was not listening. She had run to the very brink of the river. "It's not yours," she shouted. "Give it back." Kolya thought he heard an odd note in the splash of the water, as though it was making a reply. Vasya stamped her foot. "Now, catch your own fish." A deep groan came up from the depths, as of rocks grinding together, and then the basket came flying out of nowhere to hit Vasya in the chest and knock her backward. Instinctively, she clutched it and turned a grin on her brother. "Here they are," she said. "The greedy old thing just wanted..." But she stopped short at the sight of her brother's face. Wordless, she held out the basket. Kolya would have liked to make for the village and leave both his basket and his peculiar sister to themselves. But he was a man and a boyar's son, and so he stalked forward, stiff-legged, to seize his catch. He might have wished to speak. Certainly his mouth worked once or twice, rather like a fish himself, Vasya thought. But then he turned on his heel without a word and strode away. Fall came at last to lay cool fingers on the summer dry grass. The light went from gold to gray, and the clouds grew damp and soft. If Vasya still wept for her brother and sister, she did not do it where her family could see her, and she stopped asking her father every day if she was big enough to go to Moscow. But she ate her porridge with wolf-like intensity and asked Dunya often if she had grown any bigger. She avoided her sewing and her stepmother both. Anna stamped and gave shrill orders, but Vasya defied them. That summer she rambled the woods while the light lasted and into the night. There was no Sasha now to catch her when she fled, and she fled often, despite Dunya's scolding. But the days drew in, the weather worsened, and on the short, blustery afternoons, Vasya would sometimes sit indoors on her stool. There, she would eat her bread and talk to the domovoy. The domovoy was small and squat and brown. He had a long beard and brilliant eyes. At night, he crept out of the oven to wipe the plates and scour away the soot. He used to do mending, too, when people left it out. But Anna would shriek if she saw a stray shirt, and few of the servants would risk her anger. Before Vasya's stepmother arrived, they had left offerings for him, a bowl of milk or a bit of bread. But Anna shrieked then too. Dunya and the serving maids had begun hiding their offerings in odd corners where Anna rarely came. Vasya talked between bites, kicking her feet against the legs of her stool. The domovoy was stitching. She had furtively handed him her mending. His tiny fingers flicked fast as gnats on a summer day. Their conversation was, as always, rather one-sided. "Where did you come from?" Vasya asked him, her mouth full. She had asked this question before, but sometimes his answer changed. The domovoy did not look up or pause in his work. "Here," he said. "You mean there are more of you?" inquired the girl, peering about. The notion seemed to disconcert the domovoy. "No." "But if you're the only one, then where do you come from?" Philosophical conversation was not the domovoy's strong suit. his seamed brow furrowed, and there was a suggestion of hesitation in his hands.
I am here because the house is here. If the house weren't here, I wouldn't be either.
Vasilisa could not make head or tail of his answer.
So, she tried again, if the house is burned by Tatars, you'll die?
The domovoy looked as though he were struggling with an unfathomable concept.
No. But you just said that.
The domovoy intimated at this point, with a certain brusqueness in his hands, that he did not care for any more talk. Vasya had finished her bread anyway. Puzzling to herself, she slid from her stool in a scatter of crumbs. The domovoy gave her a tight-lipped glare. Guiltily, she brushed at the crumbs, scattering them further. Finally, she gave up and fled, only to trip on a loose board and carom into Anna Ivanovna, who stood in the doorway staring with her mouth half open. In her defense, Vasya did not mean to send her stepmother reeling against the doorframe, but she was strong and raw-boned for her age and could scamper very fast. Vasya looked up in quick apology but stopped, arrested. Anna was white as salt, with a little color burning in each cheek. Her breast heaved. Vasya took a step backward.
Vasya, Anna began, sounding strangled. Who were you talking to?
Vasya, taken aback, said nothing.
Answer me, child. Who were you talking to?
Vasya, disconcerted, settled on the safest answer.
No one.
Anna's glance darted from Vasya to the room behind. Abruptly, she reached out and slapped Vasya across the face. Vasya put her hand to her cheek, pale with astonished fury. The tears sprang to her eyes a moment later. Her father beat her often enough, but with a grave application of justice. She had never been struck in anger in her life.
I won't ask again, said Anna.
It's only the domovoy, Vasya whispered. Her eyes were huge. Just the domovoy.
And what manner of devil, demanded Anna shrilly, is the domovoy?
Vasya, bewildered and trying not to cry, said nothing. Anna raised a hand to slap her again.
He helps clean the house, Vasya stammered hastily. He does no harm.
Anna's eyes darted, blazing, into the room, and her face flushed dully red.
Go away, you, she screeched.
The domovoy looked up in aggrieved confusion. Anna rounded back on Vasilisa.
Domovoy?
Anna hissed, advancing on her stepdaughter.
Domovoy? There is no such thing as a domovoy.
Vasya, furious, bewildered, opened her mouth to contradict, caught her stepmother's expression, and closed it with a snap. She'd never seen anyone look so frightened.
Get out of here, cried Anna. Get out! Get out!
The last word was a screech, and Vasya turned and fled. The animal's heat struck up from below and warmed the sweet-smelling loft. Vasya buried herself in a heap of straw, chilly, bruised, and baffled.
There was no such thing as a domovoy?
Of course there was. They saw him every day. He'd been right there.
But did they see him?
Vasya couldn't recall anyone except herself talking to the domovoy. But, of course, Anna Ivanovna saw him.
Go away, she had said, hadn't she?
Maybe there wasn't such a thing as a domovoy. Perhaps she was mad. Maybe she was destined to be a holy fool and wander begging among the villages. But no, holy fools were protected by Christ. They would not be nearly as wicked as her. Vasya's head hurt with thinking. If the domovoy wasn't real, then what about the others? The Vodyanoi in the river, the twig man in the trees, the Rusalka, the Polovik, the Dvorovoy? Had she imagined them all? Was she mad? Was Anna Ivanovna? She wished she could ask Olya or Sasha. They would know, and neither of them would ever strike her. But they were far away. Vasya buried her head in her arms. She wasn't sure how long she lay there. The shadows drifted across the dim stable, She dozed a bit in the manner of tired children, and when she awoke, the light in the hayloft was gray, and she was furiously hungry. Stiffly, Vasya uncurled herself, opened her eyes, and found herself looking straight into the eyes of a strange little person. Vasya gave a moan of dismay and curled up again, pressing her fists into her eye sockets. But when she looked again, the eyes were still there, still large, brown, and tranquil, and attached to a broad face, a red nose, and a wagging white beard. The creature was quite small, no larger than Vasya herself, and he sat in a pile of hay, watching her with an expression of curious sympathy. Unlike the domovoy in his neat robe, this creature wore a collection of tattered oddments, and his feet were bare. So much Vasya saw before she squeezed her eyes shut again. But she could not sit buried in the hay forever. At last, she screwed up her courage, opened her eyes once more, and said tremulously,
"Are you a devil?"
There was a small pause.
"I don't know. Maybe. What is a devil?"
The little creature had a voice like the wicker of a kindly horse. Vasya reflected.
"A great black creature with a beard of flame and a forked tail that wishes to possess my soul and drag me off to be tortured in a pit of fire."
She eyed the little man again. Whatever he was, he did not seem to fit this description. His beard was quite reassuringly white and solid, and he was turning round and examining the seat of his trousers as though to confirm the absence of a tail.
"No," he answered at length. "I do not think that I am a devil." "Are you really here?" Vasya asked.
"Sometimes," answered the little man tranquilly. Vasya was not greatly reassured, but after a moment's reflection, she decided that "sometimes" was preferable to "never."
"Oh," she said, mollified, "what are you then?"
"I look after the horses." Vasya nodded wisely. If there was a little creature to look after the house, well then, there should be another for the stables. But the girl had learned caution.
Can everyone see you? Do they know you're here?"
"The grooms know I'm here. At least, they leave offerings on cold nights. But no one can see me. Except you. And the one other. But she never comes." He sketched a small bow in her direction. Vasya eyed him in growing consternation.
"And the domovoy? No one can see him either, can they?"
"I do not know what is a domovoy," the little creature replied equably. "I am of the stables and of the beasts that live here. I do not venture outside except to exercise the horses." Vasya opened her mouth to ask how he did so. He was no taller than she, and all of the horses had backs several handspans above her head. But at that moment she became aware of Dunya's cracked voice calling. She jumped up.
"I must go," she said. "Will I see you again?"
"If you like," the other returned. "I have never talked with anyone before."
"I am called Vasilisa Petrovna. What is your name?"
The little creature thought for a moment. "I have never had to name myself before," he said. He thought again.
"I am the Vasila, the spirit of horses," he said finally. "I suppose that you may call me so."
Vasya nodded once respectfully.
"Thank you," she said.
Then she rolled over and scurried for the hayloft ladder, trailing straw from her hair. The days wore away and the seasons. Vasya grew older, and she learned caution. She made sure never to speak to anyone but other people unless she was alone. She determined to shout less, run less, worry Dunya less, and above all, avoid Anna Ivanovna. She even succeeded somewhat for almost 7 years past in peace. If Vasya heard voices on the wind or saw faces in the leaves, she ignored them, mostly. The Vasila became the exception. He was a very simple creature. Like all household spirits, he said, he had come into being when the stables were built and remembered nothing before. But he had the generous simplicity of horses, and under her impishness, Vasilisa had a steadiness that, though she did not know it, appealed to the little stable spirit. Whenever she could, Vasya disappeared into the barn. She could watch the Vasila for hours. His movements were inhumanly light and deft, and he would clamber all over the horses' backs like a squirrel. Even Buran stood like a stone while he did so. After a while, it seemed only natural that Vasya take up knife and comb and assist him. At first, the Vasila's lessons were in craft only, in grooming and doctoring and mending. But Vasya was very eager, and soon enough he was teaching her stranger things. He taught her to talk to horses. It was a language of eye and body, sound and gesture. Vasya was young enough to learn quickly. Soon enough, she was creeping into the barn, not only for the comfort of hay and warm bodies, but for the horses' talk. She would sit in the stalls by the hour, listening. The grooms might have sent her out had they caught her, but they managed to find her surprisingly seldom. Sometimes it worried Vasya that they never found her. All she had to do was flatten herself against the side of a stall and then duck around the horse and flee, and the groom would never even look up. Part 2. Chapter 12. The Priest with the Golden Hair. In the year that Vasilisa Petrovna turned 14, the Metropolitan Alexei made his plans for the accession of Prince Dmitri Ivanovich. For 7 years, the Metropolitan had held the regency of Moscow. He schemed and skirmished, made alliances and broke them, called men to battle and sent them home again. But when Dmitri came to manhood, Alexei, seeing him bold and keen and steady in judgment, said, "Well, a good colt must not be left in pasture," and began making plans for a coronation. The robes were stitched, the furs and jewels bought, the boy himself sent to Sarai to beg the Khan's indulgence. And Alexei continued, as ever, to look quietly about him for those who might be in a position to oppose the prince's succession. It was thus that he learned of a priest named Father Konstantin Nikonovich. Konstantin was quite a young man, true, but the fortunate, or unfortunate, possessor of a terrible beauty, old gold hair and eyes like blue water. He was renowned throughout Muscovy for his piety, and despite his youth, he had traveled far, south even to Tsargrad and west to Hellas. He read Greek and could argue obscure points of theology. Moreover, he chanted with a voice like an angel, so that the people wept to hear him and lifted up their eyes to God. But most of all, Konstantin Nikonovich was a painter of icons. Such icons, said the people, as had never been seen in Moscovy. They must have come from the finger of God to bless the wicked world. Already his icons were copied throughout the monasteries of northern Rus, and Alexei's spies brought him tales of rapturous, rioting crowds, of women weeping when they kissed the painted faces. These rumors troubled the Metropolitan. "Well, and I will rid Moscow of this golden-haired priest," he said to himself. "If he is so beloved, his voice, should he choose, could turn the people against the prince." He fell to considering this means or that. While he deliberated, a messenger came from the house of Pyotr Vladimirovich. The Metropolitan sent for the man at once. The messenger arrived in due course, still in his dust and weary, awed by his glittering surroundings. But he stood steadily enough and said, "Father, bless," with only a little stammer. "God be with you," said Alexei, sketching the sign of the cross. "Tell me what brings you so far, my son." "The priest of Lesnaya Zemlya has died," explained the messenger, gulping. He had expected to explain his errand to a less exalted personage. "Good fat Father Semyon has gone to God, and we are adrift," says the mistress. "She begs you send us another to hold us fast in the wilderness." "Well," said the Metropolitan immediately, "give thanks or your salvation is just at hand. Metropolitan Alexei dismissed the messenger and sent for Konstantin Nikonovich. The young man came into the prelate's presence, tall and pale and burning. His robe of dark stuff set off the beauty of his hair and eyes. "Father Konstantin," said Alexei, "you are called to a task by God." Father Konstantin said nothing. "A woman," the metropolitan continued, "the grand prince's own sister, has sent a messenger begging our help. Her village flock is without a shepherd." The young man's face did not change. "You are the very man to go and minister to the lady and her family," Alexei finished, smiling with an air of studied benevolence. "Batyushka," said Father Konstantin. His voice was so deep it was startling. The servant at Alexei's elbow squeaked. The metropolitan narrowed his eyes. "I am honored. But already I have my work among the people of Moscow, and my icons that I have painted for the glory of God, they are here." "There are many of us to tend to the people of Moscow," replied the metropolitan. The young priest's voice was soothing and unnerving at the same time, and Alexei watched him warily. "And no one at all for those poor lost souls in the wilderness. No, no, it really must be you. You will leave in 3 weeks." "Pyotr Vladimirovich is a sensible man," thought Alexei. "3 seasons in the north will kill this upstart, or at least fade that oh-so-dangerous loveliness. Better than killing him now, lest the people take his flesh for relics and make him a martyr." Father Konstantin opened his mouth, but he caught the metropolitan's eye, which was hard as flint. The guards waited at every hand, and more in the anteroom, with long scarlet pikes. Konstantin bit back whatever he had wanted to say. "I am sure," said Alexei softly, "that you have much to do before your departure. God be with you, my son." Konstantin, white-faced and biting his red lip, bent his head stiffly and turned on his heel. His heavy robe rippled and snapped behind him as he left the room.
"Good riddance," muttered Alexei, though he was uneasy still.
He dashed kvass into a cup and tossed it cold down his throat. At high summer, the roads were grass-grown and dry. The mild sun loved the sweet-smelling earth, and soft rains scattered flowers in the forest. But Father Konstantin saw none of it. He rode beside Anna's messenger in a white-lipped rage. His fingers ached for his brushes, for his pigments and wood panels, for his cool, quiet cell. Most of all, he ached for the people, for their love and hunger and half-frightened rapture, for the way their hands stretched out to his. Devils take the meddling metropolitan. And now he was exiled for no other reason than that people preferred him. Well, he trained some village boy, see him ordained, and then be free to return to Moscow. Or perhaps go farther south to Kiev or west to Novgorod. The world was wide, and Konstantin Nikonovich would not be left to rot on some farm in the woods. Konstantin spent a week fuming, and then natural curiosity took over. The trees grew steadily larger as they rode deeper into the wild lands, oaks of giant girth and pines tall as the domes of the churches. The bright meadows grew sparser as the forest drew in on either side. The light was green and gray and purple, and the shadows lay thick as velvet. "What is it like, the land of Pyotr Vladimirovich?" Konstantin asked his companion one morning. The messenger started. They had been riding a week, and the handsome priest had hardly opened his lips except to eat his meals.
"Very beautiful, Batyushka," the man replied respectfully. "Trees fine as cathedrals, and bright streams on all sides. Flowers in summer, fruit in autumn, cold in winter, though."
"And your master and mistress?" asked Konstantin, curious despite himself.
"A good man is Pyotr Vladimirovich," said the man, warmth creeping into his voice. "Hard sometimes, but fair, and his folk never go wanting."
"And your mistress?"
Oh, a good woman, a good woman. Not like the mistress that was, but a good woman all the same. I know no harm of her.
He shot Constantine a furtive glance as he spoke, and Father Constantine wondered what it was that the messenger had not said. The day the priest arrived, Vasya was sitting in a tree talking to a Rusalka. Once, Vasya had found such conversations disconcerting, but now she had gotten used to the woman's green-skinned nakedness and the constant drip of water from her pale, weedy hair. The sprite was sitting on a thick limb with cat-like nonchalance, steadily combing her long tresses. Her comb was the Rusalka's greatest treasure, for if her hair dried, she would die. But the comb could conjure water anywhere. When she looked closely, Vasya could see the water flowing from the comb's teeth. The Rusalka had an appetite for flesh. She would snatch fawns drinking in her lake at dawn, and sometimes the young men who swam there at midsummer. But she liked Vasilisa. It was late afternoon, and the light of the long northern days shone down on the two, bringing out the radiance in Vasya's hair and fading the Rusalka to a greenish woman-shaped ghost. The water spirit was old as the lake itself, and sometimes she looked wonderingly on Vasya, the brash child of a newer world. They had become friends under strange circumstances. The Rusalka had stolen a village boy. Vasya, seeing the youth vanish, gurgling, and the flash of green fingers, had dived into the lake after him. Child though she was, she blazed with the strength of her own mortality and was a match for any Rusalka. She seized the boy and dragged him back into daylight. They made it safe to shore, the boy bruised and spitting water, staring at Vasya with equal parts gratitude and terror. He tore away from her and ran for the village as soon as he felt the earth under his feet. Vasya had shrugged and followed, wringing the water from her braid. She wanted her soup, but late in the long spring twilight, when each leaf and blade of grass stood out black against the blue-tinged air, Vasya had returned to the lake. She sat down on the verge, toes in the water.
"Did you wish to eat him?" she asked the water conversationally. "Can you not find other meat?"
There was a small, leaf-filled silence. Then,
"No,"
said a rippling voice. Vasya sprang to her feet, eyes flicking through the foliage. It was luck more than anything else that her glance lit on the sinuous outlines of a naked woman. The Rusalka crouched on a limb, a glimmering white thing clutched in one hand.
"Not meat," the creature had said with a shudder, hair scudding like wavelets over her skin. "Fear and desire. Not that you know anything of either. It flavors the water and nourishes me. Dying, they know me for who I am. Otherwise, I'd be no more than lake and tree and waterweed."
"But you kill them," said Vasya.
"Everything dies.
I will not let you slay my people."
"Then I will disappear," replied the Rusalka without inflection.
Vasya thought for a moment.
"I know you're here. I can see you. I am not dying, and I am not afraid. But I can see you. I could be your friend. Is that enough?"
The Rusalka was looking at her curiously.
"Perhaps."
And true to her word, Vasya would come looking for the water spirit, and in spring she threw flowers into the lake, and the Rusalka did not die. In return, the Rusalka taught Vasya to swim, as very few could, and to climb trees like a cat, and so it was that the two found themselves together, lounging on a limb overlooking the road, as Father Constantine approached Lesnaya Zemlya. The Rusalka saw the priest first. Her eyes gleamed.
"Here comes one who would be good eating."
Vasya peered down the road and saw a man with dusty golden hair and the dark robes of a priest.
"Why?"
"He is full of desire and fear. He does not know what he desires, and he does not admit his fear, but he feels both strong enough to strangle. The man was coming closer. It was indeed a hungry face. High, protruding cheekbones cast gray shadows over his hollow cheeks. He had deep-set blue eyes and soft, full lips, though set sternly as though to hide the softness. One of her father's men rode beside him, and both horses were dusty and tired. Vasya's face lit. "I'm going home," she said. "If he has come from Moscow, he will have news of my brother and sister." The Rusalka was not looking at her, but down the path the man had taken, a hungry light in her eyes.
"You promised you wouldn't," said Vasya sharply.
The Rusalka smiled, sharp teeth gleaming between greenish lips. "Perhaps he desires death," she said. "If so, I can help him." The dooryard before the house churned like an ant pile, washed in gold by the afternoon light. A man was unsaddling the weary horses, but the priest was nowhere to be seen. Vasya ran for the kitchen door. Dunya, who met her at the threshold, hissed at the twigs in her hair and the stains on her cut-down dress.
"Vasya, where?" she said, then, "Never mind. Come on. Hurry."
She hustled the girl off to have her hair combed and her dirty clothes exchanged for a blouse and embroidered sarafan. Flushed and smarting, but more or less presentable, Vasya emerged from the room she shared with Irina. Alyosha was waiting for her. He grinned at her appearance.
"Maybe they will manage to marry you off after all, Vasochka."
"Anna Ivanovna says not," Vasya replied composedly. "Too tall, skinny as a weasel, feet and face like a frog."
She clasped her hands and raised her eyes.
"Alas, only princes in fairy tales take frog wives, and they can do magic and become beautiful on command. I fear I will have no prince, Lyoshka."
Alyosha snorted.
"I pity the prince, but do not take Anna Ivanovna to heart. She does not want you to be beautiful."
Vasya said nothing, and a quick shadow darkened her face.
"Well, so there is a new priest," Alyosha added hastily. "Curious, are you, little sister?"
The two slipped outside and circled the house. The look she gave him was limpid as a child's.
"Aren't you?" she said. "He has come from Moscow. Perhaps he will have news."
Pyotr and the priest sat together on the cool summer grass drinking kvass. Pyotr turned when he heard his children approach, and his eyes narrowed when he saw his second daughter.
"She's nearly a woman," he thought. "It is too long since I looked at her truly. She is so like and so unlike her mother."
In truth, Vasya was still awkward, but she had begun growing into her face. The bones were still rough-hewn and overlarge, her mouth still too wide and full-lipped for the rest of her. But she was compelling. The moods passed like clouds over the clear green water of her gaze, and something about her movements, the line of her neck and braided hair, caught the eye and held it. When the light struck her black hair, it did not gleam bronze as Marina's had, but dark red, like garnets caught in the silky strands. Father Constantine was regarding Vasya with raised eyebrows and a slight frown.
"And no wonder," Pyotr thought.
There was something feral about her, for all her neat gown and properly braided hair. She looked like a wild thing new caught and just barely groomed into submission.
"My son," Pyotr said hastily, "Alexei Petrovich, and this is my daughter, Vasilisa Petrovna."
Alyosha bowed both to the priest and to his father. Vasya was looking at Konstantin with transparent eagerness. Alyosha elbowed her, hard.
"Oh," said Vasya, "you are welcome here, Batyushka."
And then she added, all in a rush,
"Have you news of our brother and sister? My brother rode away 7 years ago to take his vows at the Trinity Lavra, and my sister is the Princess of Serpukhov. Tell me you have seen them."
"Her mother should take her in hand," Konstantin thought darkly.
A soft voice and a bent head were more fitting when a woman addressed a priest.
This girl stared him brazenly in the face with fey green eyes.
Enough, Vasya, said Pyotr stern. He has had a long journey.
Konstantin was spared any reply. There came a rustle of feet in the summer grass. Anna Ivanovna swept breathlessly into view, dressed in her finest. Her small daughter Irina followed her, spotless as always and pretty as a doll. Anna bowed. Irina sucked her finger and stared round-eyed at the newcomer.
Batyushka, said Anna, you are most welcome.
The priest nodded back. At least these two were proper women. The mother had a scarf wrapped around her hair, and the little girl was neat and small and reverent. But despite himself, Konstantin's glance slid sideways and caught the other daughter's interested stare.
Colors? Said Pyotr, frowning. Colors, Pyotr Vladimirovich, said Father Konstantin, trying not to betray his eagerness.
Pyotr was not sure he'd heard the priest aright. Dinner in the summer kitchen was a raucous affair. The forest was kind in the golden months, and the kitchen garden overflowed. Dunya outdid herself with delicate stews. And then we ran like hares, said Alyosha from the other side of the hearth. Beside him, Vasya blushed and covered her face. The kitchen rang with laughter.
Dyes, you mean? Said Pyotr to the priest, his face clearing. Well, you need have no fear on that score. The women will dye whatever you like.
He grinned, feeling benevolent. Pyotr was content with life. His crops grew tall and green beneath the clear, fair sun. His wife wept and shrieked and hid less since this fair-haired priest had come.
We can, Anna interjected breathlessly.
She was neglecting her stew.
Anything you like. Are you still hungry, Batyushka?
Colors, said Konstantin. Not for dyes. I wish to make paints.
Pyotr was offended. The house was painted under the eaves, scarlet and blue, but the paintwork was bright and well kept.
And if this man thought he needed to meddle.
Konstantin pointed to the icon corner opposite the door.
For the painting of icons, he said very distinctly, for the glory of God. I know what I need, but I do not know where to find it. Here in your forest.
For the painting of icons. Pyotr eyed Konstantin with renewed respect. Like ours, he said.
He squinted at the smoke-dimmed, indifferently painted Virgin in her corner. With a candle stub set before her. He had brought the family icons from Moscow, but he'd never seen an icon painter. Monks painted icons. Konstantin opened his mouth, closed it, smoothed his features, and said,
Yes, a little like them. But I must have paints, colors. Some I brought with me, but...
Icons were holy. Men would honor his house when they knew he harbored a painter of icons.
Of course, Batyushka, said Pyotr. Icons, the painting of icons. Well, we'll get you your paints.
Pyotr raised his voice. Vasya!
On the other side of the hearth, Alyosha said something and laughed. Vasya was laughing, too. The sunlight shone through her hair, and lit the freckles adorning the bridge of her nose.
Gawky, Konstantin thought. Clumsy, half-grown, but half the house watches to see what she will do next.
Vasya!
Pyotr called again, more sharply. She left off whispering and came toward them. She wore a green dress. Her hair had loosened at the temples and curled a little about her brows, beneath her red and yellow kerchief.
She is ugly, thought Konstantin,
and then wondered at himself. What was it to him if a girl was ugly?
Father,
said Vasya.
Father Konstantin wishes to go into the wood, said Pyotr. He is looking for colors. You will go with him. You will show him where the dye plants grow.
The look she threw the priest was not the simper or shy glance of a maiden. It was transparent as sunlight, bright and curious. Yes, father, she said. And to Konstantin, at dawn tomorrow, I think, Batyushka, it is best to harvest before full light. Anna Ivanovna took the moment to ladle more stew into Konstantin's bowl. By your leave, she said. He did not take his eyes off Vasya. Why couldn't some man of the village help him find his pigments? Why the green-eyed witch? Abruptly, he realized he was glaring. The brightness had faded from the girl's face. Konstantin recalled himself. My thanks, Dievushka. He sketched the sign of the cross in the air between them. Vasya smiled suddenly. Tomorrow, then, she said. Run along, Vasya, said Anna, a little shrill. The Holy Father can have no more need of you. There was a mist on the ground the next morning. The light of the rising sun turned it to fire and smoke, striped with the shadows of trees. The girl greeted Konstantin with a wary, glowing face. She was like a spirit in the haze. The forest of Lesnaya Zemlya was not like the forest around Moscow. It was wilder and crueler and fairer. The vast trees whispered together overhead, and all around, Konstantin seemed to feel eyes.
Eyes. Nonsense.
I know where the wild mint grows, said Vasya as they followed a thin dirt track. The trees made a cathedral arch above their heads. The girl's bare feet were delicate in the dust. She had a skin bag slung across her back. And there will be elderberries if we are fortunate, and blackberries, alder for yellow. But that is not enough for the face of a saint. You will paint us icons, Batyushka?
I have the red earth, the powdered stones, the black metal. I even have the lapis dust to make the Virgin's veil. But I have no green or yellow or violet, said Konstantin.
Belatedly, he heard the eagerness in his own voice.
Those we can find, said Vasya. She skipped like a child. I have never seen an icon painted, neither has anyone else. We will all come and beg you for prayers that we might stare as you work.
He had known folk to do just that. In Moscow, they thronged about his icons.
You are human after all, said Vasya,
watching the thoughts cross his face.
I wondered. You are like an icon yourself sometimes.
He did not know what she'd seen on his face and was angry at himself.
You wonder too much, Vasilisa Petrovna. Better to stay quiet at home with your little sister.
You are not the first to tell me that, said Vasya without rancor. But if I did, who would go with you at dawn to find bits of leaves? Here.
They stopped for birch and again for wild mustard. The girl was deft with her small knife. The sun rose higher, burning away the mist.
I asked you a question yesterday when I should not, said Vasya, when the lacy mustard greens were tucked in her bag. But I will ask again today, and you will please forgive a girl's eagerness, Batyushka. I love my brother and my sister. It is long since we have had news of either. My brother is called Brother Alexander now.
The priest's mouth narrowed.
I know of him, he said after a brief hesitation. There was a scandal when he took his vows under the name of his birth.
Vasya half smiled.
Our mother chose that name for him, and my brother was always stubborn.
Rumors of Brother Alexander's impious intransigence on the matter had spread throughout Moscovy, but, Konstantin reminded himself, monastic vows were not a subject for maidens. The girl had fastened her great eyes on his face. Konstantin began to feel uncomfortable.
Brother Alexander came to Moscow for the coronation of Dmitri Ivanovich. It is said he has gained a certain renown for his ministry in the villages, the priest added stiffly.
And my sister, said Vasya.
The princess of Serpukhov is honored for her piety and for her strong children, Konstantin said, wishing an end to the conversation.
Vasya spun around with a little whoop of satisfaction. I worry for them, she said. Father does too, though he pretends not. Thank you, Batyushka. And she turned on him a face all lit from within, so that Konstantin was startled and unwillingly fascinated. His expression grew colder. There was a small silence.
The path widened, and they walked abreast.
My father said you have been to the ends of the earth, said Vasya, to Tsargrad and the Palace of 1,000 Kings, to the Church of Holy Wisdom.
Yes, said Constantine.
Will you tell me of it? She said. Father says that at dusk the angels sing, and that the Tsar rules all men of God, as though he were God himself, that he has roomfuls of gems and 1,000 servants.
The question took him aback.
Not angels, Constantine said slowly. Men only, but men with voices that would not shame angels. At nightfall, they light 100,000 candles, and everywhere there is gold and music.
He stopped abruptly.
It must be like heaven, Vasya said.
Yes, said Constantine. Memory had him by the throat. Gold and silver, music, learned men, and freedom. The forest seemed to choke him.
It is not a fit subject for girls, he added.
Vasya lifted a brow. They came upon a blackberry bush. Vasya plucked a handful.
You did not want to come here, did you? She said, around the blackberries. We have no music or lights, and precious few people. Can you not go away again?
I go where God sends me, Constantine said coldly. If my work is here, then I will stay here.
And what is your work, Batyushka? Said Vasya.
She had stopped eating blackberries. For an instant, her glance darted to the trees overhead. Constantine followed her eyes, but there was nothing there. An odd feeling crept up his spine.
To save souls, he said.
He could count the freckles on her nose. If ever a girl needed saving, it was this one. The blackberries had stained her lips and her hands.
Vasya half smiled. Are you going to save us then?
If God gives me strength, I will save you.
I am only a country girl, said Vasya.
She reached again into the blackberry bush, wary of thorns.
I have never seen Tsargrad, or angels, or heard the voice of God.
But I think you should be careful, Batyushka, that God does not speak in the voice of your own wishing. We have never needed saving before.
Constantine stared at her. She only smiled at him, more child than woman, tall and thin, and stained with blackberry juice.
Hurry, she said. It will be full light soon.
That night, Father Constantine lay on his narrow cot and shivered and could not sleep. In the north, the wind had teeth that bit after sunset, even in summer. He had placed his icons, as was right, in the corner opposite the door. The Mother of God hung in the central place with the Trinity just below. At nightfall, the lady of the house, shy and officious, had given him a fat beeswax candle to set before the icons. Constantine lit it at dusk and enjoyed the golden light, but in the moonlight the candle cast sinister shadows over the Virgin's face and set strange figures dancing wildly among the three parts of the Almighty. There was something hostile about the nighttime house, almost, it seemed, to breathe.
What foolishness, thought Constantine.
Annoyed with himself, he rose, intending to blow out the candle. But as he crossed the room, he heard the distinct click of a door closing. Without thinking, he veered to the window. A woman darted across the space before the house, muffled in a heavy shawl. Plump she looked, and shapeless under the wrapper. Father Constantine could not tell who she might be. The figure came to the church door and paused. She set a hand on the bronze ring, dragged the door open, and disappeared inside. Constantine stared at the place where she'd vanished. Of course, there was nothing to prevent someone going to pray in the dead of night, but the house had its own icons. One might easily pray before them without braving the dark and the damp night air. And there had been something furtive, almost guilty, in the woman's manner. Growing more curious and irritated and wakeful by the moment, Constantine turned from the window and drew on his dark robe. His room had its own outer door. He slid noiselessly through not bothering with shoes, and made his way across the grass to the church. Anna Ivanovna knelt in the dark before the icon screen and tried to think of nothing. The scent of dust and paint, beeswax and old wood wrapped around her like a balm, while the sweat of yet another nightmare dried in the chill. She had been walking in the midnight woods this time, black shadows on all sides. Strange voices had risen around her.
"Mistress," they cried. "Mistress, please, see us, know us, lest your hearth go undefended. Please, mistress."
But she would not look. She walked on and on while the voices tore at her. At last, desperate, she began to run, hurting her feet on rocks and roots. A great cry of lamentation rose up. Suddenly her path ended. She ran on into nothingness and fell back into her skin, gasping and dripping sweat. A dream, nothing more. But her face and feet stung, and even awake, Anna could hear those voices. At last she bolted for the church and huddled at the foot of the icon screen. She could stay in the church and creep back at first light. She had done it before. Her husband was a tolerant man, though all night disappearances were awkward to explain. The soft creak of hinges slipped thief-like to her ears. Anna lurched upright and spun around. A black-robed figure, silhouetted by the risen moon, passed softly through the doorway and came toward her. Anna was too frightened to move. She stood frozen until the shadow came close enough for her to catch the gleam of old gold hair.
"Anna Ivanovna," Konstantin said, "is all well with you?"
She gaped at the priest. All her life, folk had asked her angry questions and exasperated questions.
"What are you doing?" they said, and "What is wrong with you?"
But no one had ever asked her how she did in that tone of mild inquiry. The moonlight played over the hollows of his face. Anna stuttered into speech.
Of course, Batyushka, I'm well. Forgive me.
The sob in her throat choked her. Shaking, unable to meet his eyes, she turned away, crossed herself, and knelt again before the icon screen. Father Konstantin stood over her for a moment, wordless, then turned very precisely to cross himself and kneel at the other end of the iconostasis before the tranquil face of the Mother of God. His voice as he prayed came faintly to Anna's ears, a slow, resonant murmur, though she could not catch the words. At last, the whine of her breathing quieted. She kissed the icon of Christ and slanted a glance at Father Konstantin. He was contemplating the dim images before him, hands clasped. His voice, when it came, was deep and quiet and unexpected.
"Tell me," he said, "what brings you to seek solace at such an hour?"
"They have not told you that I am mad?"
Anna replied bitterly, surprising herself.
"No," the priest said. "Are you?"
Her chin dipped in the barest fraction of a nod.
"Why?"
Her eyes flew up to meet his.
"Why am I mad?"
Her voice came out a hoarse whisper.
"No," Konstantin answered patiently. "Why do you believe that you are?"
"I see things, demons, devils, everywhere, all the time."
She felt as though she stood beyond herself. Something had taken control of her tongue and was shaping her answers. She'd never told anyone before. Half the time she refused to admit it to herself, even when she muttered at corners and the women whispered behind their hands. Even kind, drunk, clumsy Father Semyon, who had prayed with her more times than she could count, had never wrung this confession from her.
"But why should that mean you are mad? The church teaches that demons walk among us. Do you deny the teachings of the church?"
"No, but..."
Anna felt hot and cold at once. She wanted to look into his face again, but did not dare. She looked at the floor instead and saw the faint shadow of his foot, incongruously bare beneath the heavy robe. At last she managed to whisper, "But they aren't, can't be real. No one else sees. I am mad. I know I am mad." She trailed off, then added slowly, "Except sometimes I think my stepdaughter Vasilisa, but she's only a child who hears too many stories." Father Constantine's gaze sharpened. "She speaks of it, does she?"
Not recently. But when she was a little girl, sometimes I thought, her eyes."
"And you did nothing?"
Constantine's voice was supple as a snake and well-tuned as any singer's. Anna quailed under his tone of incredulous contempt.
"I beat her when I could and forbade her to talk of it. I thought maybe that if I caught her young enough, the madness wouldn't take hold."
"Is that all you thought? Madness? Did you never fear for her soul?"
Anna opened her mouth, closed it again, and stared at the priest, bewildered. He stalked toward the center of the iconostasis, where a second Christ sat enthroned, surrounded by apostles. The moonlight turned his gold hair to gray silver, and his shadow crawled black across the floor.
"Demons can be exorcised, Anna Ivanovna," he said, not taking his eyes from the icon.
Exorcised? She squeaked.
"Naturally."
"How?"
She felt as though she were thinking through mud. All her life she had borne her curse, that it might just go away. Her mind wouldn't compass the notion.
"Rites of the church and much prayer."
There was a small silence.
"Oh," Anna breathed, "oh, please, make it go away. Make them go away."
He might have smiled, but she couldn't be sure in the moonlight.
"I will pray and think on it. Go back and go to sleep, Anna Ivanovna."
She stared at him with big, stunned eyes, then whirled and blundered toward the door, feet clumsy on the bare wood. Father Constantine prostrated himself before the iconostasis. He did not sleep at all the rest of the night. The next day was Sunday. In the green-gray dawn, Constantine returned to his own room. Heavy-eyed, he flung cold water over his head and washed his hands. Soon he must give service. He was weary but calm. During the long hours of his vigil, God had given him the answer. He knew what evil lay upon this land. It was in the sun symbols on the nurse's apron, in that stupid woman's terror, in the fey, feral eyes of Piotr's elder daughter. The place was infested with demons, the Certi of the old religion. These foolish, wild people worshipped God by day and the old gods in secret. They tried to walk both paths at once, and made themselves base in the sight of the Father. No wonder evil had come to work its mischief. Excitement rolled through his veins. He thought to molder here in the back of beyond. But here was battle indeed, a battle for mastery of the souls of men and women, with evil on one side and him as God's messenger on the other. The people were gathering. He could almost feel their eager curiosity. It was not yet like Moscow, where people snatched hungrily at his words and loved him with their frightened eyes. Not yet, but it would be. Vasya twitched a shoulder and wished she could take off her headdress. Because they were in church, Dunya had added a veil to the heavy contrivance of cloth and wood and semi-precious stones. It itched, but she was nothing compared to Anna, who was dressed as though for a feast day, a jeweled cross round her neck and rings on each finger. Dunya had taken one look at her mistress and muttered under her breath about piety and gold hair. Even Pyotr raised an eyebrow at his wife, but he held his peace. Vasya followed her brothers into church, scratching her scalp. Women stood on the left of the nave before the Virgin, while men stood on the right in front of the Christ. Vasya had always wished she could stand next to Alyosha so they could poke and fidget during the service. Irina was so small and sweet that poking was not rewarding, and anyway, Anna always saw. Vasya locked her fingers behind her back. The doors at the center of the iconostasis opened, and the priest came out. The murmurs of the assembled village drifted into silence, punctuated by a girl's giggle. The church was small, and Father Constantine seemed to fill it. His golden hair drew the eye as even Anna's jewels could not. His blue gaze pierced the throng like knives, one at a time. He did not speak at once. A breathless hush spread like sound among the people, so that Vasya found herself straining to hear their soft, eager breathing. "Blessed is the kingdom," said Constantine at last, his voice washing over them, "of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, now and ever and unto ages of ages." He didn't sound like Father Semyon, thought Vasya, though the words of the liturgy were the same. His voice was like thunder, yet he placed each syllable like Dunya setting stitches. Under his touch, the words came alive. His voice was deep as rivers in spring. He spoke to them of life and death, of God and of sin. He spoke of things they did not know, of devils and torments and temptation. He called it up before their eyes, so that they saw themselves submitting to the judgment of God, and saw themselves damned and flung down. As he chanted, Constantine pulled the crowd to him until they echoed his words in a daze of fascinated terror. He drove them on and on with a supple lash of his voice until their answering voices broke and they listened like children frightened during a thunderstorm. Just as they were on the verge of panic or rapture, his voice gentled. "Have mercy on us and save us, for he is good and the lover of mankind." A heavy silence fell. In the stillness, Constantine raised his right hand and blessed the crowd. They trickled out of the church like sleepwalkers, clutching one another. Anna had a look of exalted terror that Vasya couldn't understand. The others looked dazed, even exhausted, the trailing ends of fearful rapture in their eyes.
"Yoshka!"
Vasya called, darting over to her brother. But when he turned to her, he was pale like the others, and his gaze seemed to meet hers from a long way away. She slapped him, frightened to see his eyes blank. Abruptly, Alyosha came back to himself and gave her a shove that should have put her in the dust, but she was quick as a squirrel and wearing a new gown. So she writhed backward and kept her feet, and then the two were glaring at each other, chests heaving and fists clenched. They both recovered their senses at the same time. They laughed, and Alyosha said, "Is it true then, Vasya? Demons among us and torments in store if we do not cast them out? But the Cherti, is he talking about the Cherti? The women have always left bread for the domovoy. What care has God for that?"
"Stories or no, why should we cast out the household spirits on the word of some old priest from Moscow?" snapped Vasya. "We have always left them bread and salt and water, and God was not angry."
"We have not starved," said Alyosha hesitantly,
"and there have been no fires or sickness. But perhaps God is waiting for us to die so that our punishment might never end."
"For heaven's sake, Lyoshka," Vasya began, but she was interrupted by Dunya calling.
Anna had decreed a meal of special magnificence, and Vasya must roll dumplings and stir the soup. They dined outside on eggs and kasha and summer greens, bread and cheese and honey. The usual cheerful muddle was subdued. The young peasant women stood in knots and whispered. Constantine, chewing meditatively, wore a glow of satisfaction. Pyotr, frowning, swung his head here and there like the bull that scents danger, but has not yet seen the wolves in the grass.
"Father understands wild beasts and raiders," thought Vasya, "but sin and damnation cannot be fought."
The others gazed at the priest with terror and a hungry admiration. Anna Ivanovna glowed with a kind of hesitant joy. Their fervor seemed to lift Constantine and carry him like a galloping horse. Vasya did not know it, but in the silence of the nave after all the people had gone, the priest had thrown that feeling into his exorcism, thrown it all, until even a man without the sight would swear he could hear devils crying out and running for their lives, out of Pyotr's walls and far away. That summer, Constantine went among the people and listened to their woes. He blessed the dying and he blessed the newborn. He listened when spoken to. And when his deep voice rang out, the people fell silent to hear him. "Repent," he told them, "lest you burn. The fire is very near. It is waiting for you and for your children, each time you lie down to sleep. Give your fruits to God and God alone. It is your only salvation." The people murmured together, and the murmurs grew more and more fearful. Constantine ate at Pyotr's table every night. His voice set their honey wine rippling and rattled their wooden spoons. Irina took to putting her spoon against her cup, giggling to hear them click together. Vasya abetted her in this. The child's gaiety was a relief. Talk of damnation did not frighten Irina. She was too young. But Vasya was frightened, not of the priest and not of devils nor of pits of fire. She had seen their devils. She saw them every day. Some were wicked and some were kind and some were mischievous. All were as human in their way as the folk they guarded. No, Vasya was frightened of her own people. They did not joke on the way to church anymore. They listened to Father Constantine in heavy, hungry silence. And even when they were not in church, the people made excuses to visit his room. Constantine had begged beeswax from Pyotr, which he would melt and mix with his pigments. When the daylight shone into his cell, he would take up brushes and open files of crushed powders, and then he would paint. Saint Peter took form under his brush. The saint's beard was curly, his robe yellow and umber, his strange, long-fingered hand raised in benediction. Lesnaya Zemlya could talk of nothing else. One Sunday, desperate, Vasya smuggled a handful of crickets into the church and dropped them among the worshippers. Their chirping made an amusing counterpoint to Father Constantine's deep voice, but no one laughed. They cringed and whispered of evil omens. Anna Ivanovna had not seen, but she did suspect who was behind it. After the service, she called Vasya to her. Vasya came unwillingly to her stepmother's chamber. A length of willow lay ready in Anna's hand. The priest sat by the open window, grinding a scrap of blue stone to powder. He did not seem to listen while Anna questioned her stepdaughter, but Vasya knew the questions were for the priest's benefit, to show her stepmother righteous and mistress in her own house. The questioning went on and on. "I would do it again," snapped Vasya at last, exasperated beyond caution. "Did not God make all creatures? Why should we alone be allowed to raise our voices in praise? Crickets worship with songs as much as we." Constantine's blue glance flicked toward her, though she could not read his expression. "Insolence!" shrieked Anna. "Sacrilege!" Vasya, chin high, kept silence even as her stepmother's willow switch whistled down. Constantine watched, grave and inscrutable. Vasya met his eyes and refused to look away. Anna saw the girl and the priest, their steady mutual regard, and her furious face turned redder than ever. She put all the strength of her arm into the sharp willow. Vasya stood still for it, biting her lip bloody. But the tears welled, despite her best efforts, and hurried down her cheeks. Behind Anna, Constantine watched, wordless. Vasya cried out once toward the end, as much in humiliation as in pain. But then it was over. Alyosha, white-lipped, had gone to find their father. Pyotr saw the blood and his daughter's white face and seized Anna's arm. Vasya said no word to her father or to anyone else. She stumbled away at once, though her brother tried to call her back, and hid in the wood like a wounded thing. If she wept, only the Rusalka heard.
That will teach her the price of sin, said Anna proudly when Pyotr reproved her for brutality. Better she learn now than burn later, Pyotr Vladimirovich.
Constantine said nothing. What he thought, he did not say. After her cuts healed, Vasya walked more softly and held her tongue more readily. She spent more time with the horses and concocted wild plans to dress as a boy and go to join Sasha in his monastery or send a secret messenger to Olga. Alyosha, though he did not tell her, began to mark her comings and goings so that she was never alone with her stepmother. All this while, Constantine condemned the people's offerings, bread or honey wine, that they made to their hearth spirits.
Give it to God, he said. Forget your demons lest you burn.
The people listened. Even Dunya was half convinced, she muttered to herself, shook her old head, and picked the sun symbols from aprons and kerchiefs. Vasya did not see it. She hid in the wood or in the stable. But the domovoy regretted her absence more than anyone else, because for him now there was nothing but crumbs.
Chapter 13 Wolves. Fall came in a burst of glory that quickly faded to gray. The silence of the waning year lay like a haze over the lands of Pyotr Vladimirovich, while the icons multiplied under Father Constantine's hand. The men of the village labored over a new icon screen to hold them, St. Peter and St. Paul, the Virgin and the Christ. The people lingered about Constantine's room and gazed with awe at the finished icons, at their shapes and shining faces. Constantine was making a whole iconostasis, one image at a time.
You owe your salvation to God, said Constantine. Look on his face and be saved.
They had never seen anything like his Christ's great eyes, the pale flesh, and the long, thin hands. They looked and knelt and sometimes cried.
What is a domovoy, they said, but a tale for bad children? We are sorry, Batyushka. We repent.
Almost no one made offerings, even at the autumn equinox. The domovoy grew feeble and listless. The vazila grew thin and haggard and wild-eyed. The straw lay thick in his tangled beard. He stole rye and barley, stored for the horses. The horses themselves began stamping in their stalls and shying at breezes. Tempers in the village grew short.
Well, it wasn't me, boy. And it wasn't a horse or a cat or a ghost, snarled Pyotr to the stable boy one bitter morning.
More barley had vanished in the night, and Pyotr, already on edge, was furious.
I didn't see, cried the boy, sniffling. I would never.
The air smarted, those mornings in November, and the earth seemed to ring underfoot, brittle with frost. Pyotr stood nose to nose with the youth, and answered his denials with a clenched fist. There was a thud and a howl of pain.
Never steal from me again, Pyotr said.
Vasya, just slipping through the stable door, frowned. Her father was never short-tempered. He never even beat Anna Ivanovna.
What is happening to us?
Vasya ducked out of sight and climbed into the hayloft. It took her a moment to locate the vazila, who was curled in on himself and half buried in straw. She shivered at the look in his eyes.
Why are you eating the barley? She asked, gathering her courage.
Because there have been no offerings.
The vazila's eyes glowed disconcertingly black.
Are you frightening the horses?
Their moods are mine and mine theirs.
You are very angry then? The girl whispered. But my people do not mean it. They are only frightened.
The priest will go away one day. Things will not always be so. The vazila's eyes gleamed darkly.
but Vasya thought she saw sorrow in them, as well as anger.
I am hungry, he said.
Vasya felt a rush of sympathy. She had often been hungry.
I can bring you bread, she said stoutly. I am not frightened.
The Vasila's eyelids flickered. I need little, he said. Bread, apples. Vasya tried not to think too hard about giving away part of her meals. Food was never plentiful after midwinter. Soon she would be grudging every crumb. But
I will bring them to you, I swear it,
she said, looking earnestly into the demon's round brown eyes.
My thanks, returned the Vasila. Keep your pledge, and I will leave the grain alone.
Vasya kept her pledge. It was never much, a withered apple, a gnawed crust, a drip of honey wine, carried on her fingers or in her mouth. But the Vasila came for it eagerly, and when he ate, the horses quieted. The days darkened and drew in. The snow fell as though to seal them up in whiteness. But the Vasila grew pink and content. The wintertime stable grew drowsy, as of old. Just as well. The season was a long one, and in January, the cold deepened until even Dunya could remember nothing like it. The remorseless winter dusk drove folk indoors. Pyotr had plenty of time to suffer the sight of his family's pinched faces. They huddled by the fire, chewing at bread and strips of dried meat, taking turns adding wood to the blaze. Even by night, they did not dare let it burn low. The older folk murmured that their firewood burned too fast, that it took 3 logs to keep the flames high, where before they had needed 1. Pyotr and Kolya decried that as nonsense, but their wood piles dwindled. Midwinter had come and gone, the days lengthened once more, but the cold only worsened. It killed sheep and rabbits and blackened the fingers of the unwary. Firewood they must have in such cold, come what may, and so as their stocks ran low, the people dared the silent forest under the glare of the winter sun. It was Vasya and Alyosha, out with a pony, a sledge, and short-hafted axes, who saw the paw prints in the snow.
Ought we go after them, father? Kolya asked that night. Kill some, take their skins, and drive the rest away?
He was mending a scythe, squinting in the oven light. His son Seryozha, stiff and silent, huddled against his mother. Vasya had given the enormous basket of sewing a dispirited look and seized her axe and a whetstone. Alyosha shot her an amused look over the haft of his own axe.
See, said Father Constantine to Anna, look around you. In God's grace is your deliverance.
Anna's eyes were fastened on his face. Her sewing lay forgotten on her lap. Pyotr wondered at his wife. She had never seemed so much at ease, though this was the bitterest winter in memory.
I think not, said Pyotr, in answer to his son's question. He was inspecting his boots.
In winter, holes could cost a man a foot. He put one down near the fire and picked up the other.
They are bigger than boar hounds, the wolves from the high north. It has been 20 years since they came so near.
Pyotr reached down and caressed Pios's gaunt head. The dog gave him a dispirited lick.
That they do so now means they are desperate, that they would hunt children if they could, or slaughter sheep under our noses. The men together might take on a pack, but it is too cold for bows. It would be spear work, and not everyone would come back. No, we must look to our children and our livestock, and only go into the forest in daylight.
We might set snares, put in Vasya, over the scrape of her whetstone.
Anna gave her a dark look.
No, Pyotr said. Wolves are not rabbits. They would smell you on the trap, and no one will risk the forest on such a small chance of gain.
Yes, father, Vasya said meekly.
That night was deadly cold. They all huddled together on top of the oven, packed like salted fish, and covered with every blanket they possessed. Vasya slept badly. Her father snored, and Irina's small, sharp knees dug into her back. She tossed and turned, tried not to kick Alyosha, and at last, near midnight, fell into a shallow sleep. She dreamed of wolves howling, of winter stars swallowed up by warm clouds, of a man with red hair, a woman on horseback, and last, of a pale, heavy-jawed man with a look of hunger and malice, who leered and winked his single good eye. She woke up gasping in the bitter hour before dawn and saw a figure cross the room, outlined by the light of the banked oven fire. "It is nothing," she thought. "A dream. The kitchen cat." But then the figure paused, as though it sensed her regard. It turned a fraction. Vasya hardly dared to breathe, for she saw its face, a pale scrawl in the dim light. The eyes were the color of winter ice. She drew breath to speak or to scream, but then the figure was gone. Daylight was filtering in round the kitchen door, and from the village there came a wailing cry. "It is Timofey," said Pyotr, naming a village boy. Pyotr had risen before dawn to see to his stock. Now he came briskly through the door, stamping snow from his boots and brushing away the ice that had formed in his beard. He was hollow-eyed from cold and sleeplessness. He died in the night. The kitchen filled with exclamations. Vasya, half awake on the oven, remembered the figure that had passed in the darkness. Dunya said nothing at all, but went about her baking, lips set. Her glance flicked often and worriedly from Vasya to Irina. Winter was cruel to the young. At mid-morning, the women gathered in the bathhouse to wrap his wasted body. Vasya, spilling into the hut behind her stepmother, caught a glimpse of Timofey's face. He was glassy-eyed, the tears frozen on his thin cheeks. His mother clutched the stiffening body to her, whispering to him, ignoring her neighbors. Neither patience nor reason would draw the child from her, and when the women tugged him forcibly from her arms, she began to scream. The room dissolved into chaos. The mother flew at her neighbors, crying for her son. Most of the women had children themselves. They quailed at the look in her eyes. The mother clawed blindly, scrabbling. The room was too small. Vasya thrust Irina out of harm's way and seized the reaching arms. She was strong but slender, and the mother was wild with grief. Vasya clung and tried to speak. "Let go of me, witch!" screamed the woman. "Let go!" Vasya, disconcerted, loosened her grip, and an elbow caught her across the face. She saw stars, and her arms fell away. In that moment, Father Constantine appeared in the doorway. His nose was red, his face as raw as anyone's, but he absorbed the scene in an instant, took two strides across the tiny hut, and caught the mother's groping fingers. The woman gave one desperate wrench and then stilled, trembling.
"He is gone, Yasna," Constantine said, stern.
"No," she croaked. "I held him in my arms. All last night I held him as the fire burned low. He cannot, he will not leave if I hold him. Give him back to me."
"He belongs to God," said Constantine, "as do we all."
"He is my son, my only son, mine."
"Be still," he said. "Sit down. This is unseemly.
Come, the women will lay him before the fire and heat water for washing." His deep voice was soft and even. Yasna allowed him to lead her to the oven and sank down beside it. All that morning, indeed, all that brief, dull winter day, Constantine talked, and Yasna stared at him like a swimmer caught in a riptide, while the women stripped Timofey's body and washed it and wrapped it in cold linen. The priest was still there when Vasya came back from another bitter day searching for firewood. She saw him standing before the door of the bathhouse, gulping the cold air as though it were water.
"Would you like some meat, Batyushka?" she said.
Konstantin jerked in surprise. Vasya made no noise walking, and her gray furs mingled with the falling night. But after a pause, he said,
"I would, Vasilisa Petrovna."
His beautiful voice was little more than a thread, the resonance gone. Gravely, she handed him her little skin of honey wine. He gulped it with desperate eagerness. Wiping his mouth with the back of his hand, he handed the skin back to her, only to find her studying him, a furrow between her brows.
"Will you keep vigil tonight?" she asked. "It is my place," he replied with a hint of hauteur. The question was impertinent.
She saw his annoyance and smiled. He frowned.
"I honor you for it, Batyushka," she said.
She turned toward the great house, melting into the shadows. Konstantin watched her go, lips pressed together. The taste of mead was heavy in his mouth. The priest kept that night's vigil by the body. His gaunt face was set, and his lips moved in prayer. Vasya, who had returned in the small hours to keep her own vigil, could not help but admire his steady purpose, though the air had never echoed so with sobs and prayers as it had since his coming. It was far too cold to linger over the boy's tiny grave, hacked with much labor out of the iron-hard earth. As soon as decency permitted, the people scattered back to their huts, leaving the poor thing alone in his icy cradle, with Father Konstantin hindmost, half-dragging the bereaved mother. People began cramming into fewer and fewer izby, with extended families sharing one oven to save firewood. But the wood disappeared so quickly, as though some ill wish made it burn. So they went into the woods, regardless of paw prints, the women goaded by the sight of Timofey's marble face and the dreadful look in his mother's eyes. It was inevitable that someone would not come back. Oleg's son, Daniil, was only bones when they found him, scattered widely over a stretch of trampled and bloody snow. His father brought the gnawed bone ends to Pyotr and, wordless, laid them before him. Pyotr looked down at them and said nothing.
"Pyotr Vladimirovich," Oleg began, croaking, but Pyotr shook his head. "Bury your son," he said, his glance lingering on his own children. "I shall summon the men tomorrow."
Alyosha spent the long night checking the haft of his boar spear and sharpening his hunting knife. A little color showed in his beardless cheeks. Vasya watched him work. Part of her itched to take up a spear herself, to go and brave dangers in the winter wood. The other part wanted to crack her brother over the head for his heedless excitement.
"I will bring you a wolfskin, Vasya," Alyosha said, laying his weapons aside. "Keep your wolfskin," Vasya retorted, "if you can only promise to bring your own skin back without freezing your toes off."
Her brother grinned, his eyes glittering.
"Worried, little sister?"
The two sat apart from the mob near the oven, but Vasya still lowered her voice.
"I don't like this. Do you think I want to have to chop your frozen toes off, or your fingers?" "But there's no help for it, Vasochka," said Alyosha, putting down his boot. "Wood we must have. Better to go out and fight than freeze to death in our houses."
Vasya pursed her lips, but made no answer. She thought suddenly of the Vasila, black-eyed with wrath. She thought of the crusts she brought him to quiet his anger.
"Is there another who is angry?"
Such a one could only be in the wood, where the cold winds blew and the wolves howled.
"Don't even think it, Vasya," said the sensible voice in her skull. But Vasya glanced at her family.
She saw her father's grim face, her brother's suppressed excitement.
"Well, I can but try." If Alyosha is hurt tomorrow, I will hate myself forever if I did not try.
Without pausing to think longer, Vasya went for her boots and winter cloak. No one bothered asking where she was going. The truth would not have occurred to anyone. Vasya climbed the palisade, hampered by her mittens. The stars were few and faint. The moon cast a blaze of light over the hard frozen snow.
Vasya passed the eave of the wood from moonlight into darkness. She walked briskly. It was dreadfully cold. The snow squeaked under her feet. Somewhere, a wolf howled.
Vasya tried not to think of the yellow eyes. Her teeth would surely rattle out of her head from shivering.
Suddenly, Vasya stumbled to a halt. She thought she'd heard a voice. Slowing her breath, she listened. No, only the wind. But what was that there? It looked like a great tree, one she half remembered, with an odd sly memory that slid in and out of her mind.
No, it was only a shadow cast by the moon. A bone-chilling wind played in the branches high above. Out of the hiss and clatter, Vasya suddenly thought she heard words.
Are you warm, child? Said the wind, half laughing.
In fact, Vasya felt her bones would splinter like frost-killed branches, but she replied steadily,
Who are you? Are you sending the frost?
There was a very long silence. Vasya wondered if she had imagined the voice. Then it seemed she heard mockingly,
And why not? I, too, am angry.
The voice seemed to throw echoes so that the whole wood took up the cry.
That is no answer, retorted the girl.
The sensible part of her pointed out that perhaps a little meekness was in order when dealing with half-heard voices in the dead of night. But the cold was making her sleepy. She fought it with every scrap of will and had none left over for meekness.
I bring the frost, said the voice.
Suddenly it was curling icy, loving fingers about her face and throat. A cold touch like fingertips slipped beneath her clothes and wrapped round her heart.
Then will you stop? Vasya whispered, fighting fear.
Her heart beat as though against another's hand.
I speak for my people. They are afraid. They are sorry. Soon it will be as it always was. Our churches and our charity together, and no more fear or talk of demons.
It will be too late, said the wind, and the forest took it up.
Too late, too late.
Then, besides, it is not my frost you should fear, Dievushka. It is the fires. Tell me, do your fires burn too fast?
It is only the cold that makes them burn so.
Nay, it is the coming storm. The first sign is fear. The second is always fire. Your people are afraid. And now the fires burn.
Turn the storm aside then, I beg you, said Vasya. Here, I brought a gift.
She put a hand into her sleeve. It was nothing much. Just a scrap of dry bread and a pinch of salt, but when she held it out, the wind died. In the silence, Vasya heard the wolf howl again, very near now, and answered in a chorus. But in the same instant, a white mare stepped out from between two trees, and Vasya forgot the wolves. The mare's long mane fell like icicles, and her snorting breath made a plume in the night. Vasya caught her breath.
Oh, you are beautiful, she said,
and even she could hear the longing in her voice.
Are you bringing the frost?
Did the white mare have a rider? Vasya could not tell. One instant it seemed she did, and then the mare twitched her skin, and the shape on her back was only a trick of the light. The white horse put her small ears forward toward the bread and salt. Vasya held out her hand. She felt the horse's warm breath on her face and stared into her dark eye. Suddenly, she felt warmer. Even the wind felt warmer, where it twined around her face.
"I bring the frost," said the voice.
Vasya did not think it was the mare.
"It is my wrath and my warning, but you are brave, Dyevushka, and I relent, for the sake of an offering."
A small pause.
"But the fear is not mine, and neither are the fires. The storm is coming, and the frost will be as nothing beside it. Courage will save you. If your people are afraid, then they are lost."
"What storm?" whispered Vasya.
"Beware the turning seasons," she thought the wind sighed. "Beware." And the voice was gone.
But the wind remained. Harder and harder it blew, wordless, flinging clouds across the moon, and the wind smelled blessedly of snow. The deep frost could not last while it snowed. When Vasya stumbled back through the door of her own house, the flakes that covered her hood and caught in her eyelashes effectively silenced her family's clamor. Alyosha seized her in speechless delight, and Irina went laughing outside to catch a handful of the falling whiteness. That night, the cold indeed broke. It snowed for a week. When the snow finally stopped, it took them 3 more days to dig themselves out. By then, the wolves had taken advantage of the relative warmth to feast on stringy rabbits and move deeper into the forest. No one ever saw them again. Only Alyosha seemed disappointed. Dunya slept badly those late winter nights, and it was not only because of the cold and aching of her bones, nor yet her worry over Irina's cough or Vasya's pale face.
"It is time," said the frost demon.
There was no sledge in Dunya's dream this time, no sunshine or crisp winter air. She stood in a gloomy and muttering forest. It seemed that a greater shadow lurked somewhere in the dark, waiting. The winter demon's pale features were drawn fine as etching, his eyes drained of color.
"It must be now," he said. "She is a woman, and stronger than even she knows. I can perhaps keep evil from you, but I must have that child."
"She is a child," protested Dunya.
"Demon," she thought. "Tempter. Liar. A child still. She teases me for honey cakes, even when she knows there are none. And she has grown so pale this winter, all eyes and bones. How can I give her up now?"
The demon's face was cold.
"My brother is waking. Every day his prison weakens. That child, all unknowing, has done what she can to protect you, with crusts and courage and the sight. But my brother laughs at such things. She must have the jewel."
The dark seemed to press closer, hissing. The frost demon spoke sharply, in words Dunya did not know. A bright wind filtered around the clearing, and the shadows drew back. The moon came out and set the snow to glowing.
"Please, Winter King," Dunya said humbly, clenching her hands together. "Another year, one more sun season. She will grow strong with rain and sunlight. I cannot give my girl to winter now."
Laughter suddenly boomed from the undergrowth. Old, slow laughter. Suddenly it seemed to Dunya that the moonlight shone through the frost demon, that he was nothing but a trick of light and shadow. But then he was a real man again, with weight and shape and form. His head was turned away, scanning the undergrowth. When he turned back to Dunya, his face was grim.
"You know her best," he said. "I cannot take her unready. She will die."
"Another year, then.
against my judgment.
Chapter 14. The Mouse and the Maiden. Anna Ivanovna suffered with the others that winter. Her hands swelled and stiffened. Her teeth ached. She dreamed of cheese and eggs and cresses, all the while eating sour cabbage and black bread and smoked fish. Irina, never strong, faded to a listless shadow of herself, and Anna, terrified for her child, found a strange kinship with Dunya in coaxing broths and honey down the child's throat and keeping her warm. But at least she saw no demons. The little bearded creature did not creep about the house. The twiggy brown beggar did not creep about the dvor. Anna saw only men and women and endured only the ordinary troubles of a crowded house in a bad winter. And Father Constantine was there, a man like an angel, such as she had never imagined a man to be, with his shining voice and tender mouth and the blessed icons that took shape under his strong hands. She saw him every day that winter, when they were all cooped up indoors. It was meat and drink to her to bask in his presence, and she desired nothing more. Her mind was at ease. She could even bring herself to smile at her stepsons and endure Vasilisa. But when the snow came and the cold broke, Anna's peace was shattered. A gray noontide, with little snow flurries out of a leaden sky, found Anna running to find Constantine in his cell. "The demons are still here, Batyushka," she cried. "They came back. They were only hiding before. They are sly. They are liars. How have I sinned? Father, what must I do?" She was weeping, shivering. Only that morning, the domovoy had crept, stubborn and smoldering, out of the oven and taken up Dunya's basket of mending. Constantine did not answer at once. His fingers were blue and white where they gripped the brush. He had retreated to his room to paint. Anna had brought him soup. It sloshed in her trembling hands. "Cabbage," Constantine noted with disgust. He was mortally weary of cabbage. Anna put the bowl down beside him, but she did not go.
"Patience, Anna Ivanovna," the priest replied, when it became clear she was waiting for him to speak.
He did not turn around, nor slow his quick, dabbing brushstrokes. It was weeks since he had painted. "It is an infestation of longstanding, fed by the straying of many. Only wait, and I will bring them back to God."
"Yes, Batyushka," Anna said. "But today I saw,"
he hissed between his teeth. "Anna Ivanovna, you will never be rid of devils if you creep around looking for them. What good Christian woman behaves so? You would do better to fear God and pass your time in prayer, much prayer."
He glanced pointedly toward the door. But Anna did not go.
"You have done wonders already. Do not think me ungrateful, Batyushka."
She swayed toward him, trembling. Her hand dropped onto his shoulder. Constantine shot her an impatient glance. She jerked back as though burned, and a dull flush crept up her face.
"Give thanks to God, Anna Ivanovna," Constantine said. "Leave me to my work."
She stood a moment, wordless, and then fled. Constantine seized his soup and swallowed it at a gulp. He wiped his mouth and tried again to find the calm needful for painting. But the lady's words scratched at him.
"Demons, devils, how have I sinned?"
Constantine's mind wandered. He had filled these people with the fear of God, and they were on the path to salvation. They needed him, loved and feared him in equal measure. Rightly, for he was God's messenger. They worshipped his icons. All that he could contrive with words and fierce looks, of obedience to God's will and spirit of humility, he had done. He felt the effect. And yet, unwillingly, Constantine thought of Pyotr's second daughter. He had watched her that winter, her childish grace, her laughter, her careless impudence, the secret sadness that sometimes crossed her face. He remembered how once she had emerged out of the dusk, at home in the cold and the falling night. He himself had taken mead from her hand, not thinking beyond his gratitude that he might slake his thirst.
"She is not afraid," Constantine thought dourly. "She does not fear God. She fears nothing."
He saw it in her silences, her fey glance, the long hours she spent in the forest. In any case, no good Christian maid ever had eyes like that, or walked with such grace in the dark. For her soul and for the souls of all in this desolate place, thought Constantine, he must have her humility. She must see what she was and fear it. Save her, and he would save them all. Failing that, Constantine paid no mind to his fingers. He painted in a haze while his mind worried away at the problem. At last he swam back to consciousness, and his eyes took in what he had painted. Wild green eyes stared back at him that he had meant to make only a gentle blue. The woman's long veil could just as easily have been a curtain of red-black hair. She seemed to laugh at him, caught in the wood and forever free. Constantine shouted and flung the board away. It thudded to the floor, splattering paint. That spring was too wet and too cold. Irina, who loved flowers, wept, for the snowdrops never bloomed. The fields were plowed under torrents of unseasonable rain, and for weeks nothing would dry, indoors or out. Vasya, in desperation, tried putting their stockings in the oven with the fire pushed to one corner. She withdrew them considerably warmer, but no drier. Half the village was coughing, and she looked her brother over frowningly as he came to dress.
"As your experiments go, this one could have been worse," said Alyosha, eyeing his slightly charred stockings.
His eyes were red, his voice hoarse. He made a face as he pulled the warm, damp wool over his foot.
"Yes," said Vasya, drawing on her own stockings. "I could have cooked a lot."
She eyed him again.
"There will be something hot for dinner tonight. Don't die before the rain stops, little brother."
"No promises, little sister," said Alyosha darkly, coughing.
He straightened his hat and slipped outside. With the rain and the damp, Father Constantine took to making his brushes and grinding his stone in the winter kitchen. It was considerably warmer and somewhat drier than his room, though much noisier with dogs and children and the feeblest of their goats underfoot. Vasya regretted the change. He never once spoke to her, though he commended Irina and instructed Anna Ivanovna often enough. But even in the uproar, Vasya could feel his eyes on her, while she joked with Dunya, kneaded their poor thin bread, and plied her distaff. Vasya was always aware of the priest's steady stare.
"Better to tell me my fault to my face, Batyushka."
She hid in the stable whenever she could. Her forays into the crowded house meant rounds of unremitting work, while Anna screeched and prayed by turns. And always there was the priest's silence and his grave regard. Vasya never told anyone where she'd gone that bitter night in January. Afterward, she sometimes thought she had dreamed it, the voice on the wind and the white horse. With Constantine watching, she was careful to address no remarks to the domovoy. But the priest watched her all the same. It was, she thought, almost despairing, simply a matter of time before she got herself into trouble and he pounced. But the days ran together, and the priest kept his silence. April came, and Vasya found herself in the horse pasture, stitching up Mish, Sasha's old horse, now a brood mare who had borne 7 foals. Though no longer young, the mare was still strong and sound, and her wise old eyes missed nothing. The most valuable horses, Mish among them, spent the winter in the stable and went out to pasture with the others as soon as the grass showed through the snow. Certain disagreements always arose in consequence, and Mish had a hoof-shaped gash on her flank. Vasya plied her needle more deftly in flesh than she did in cloth. The scarlet slash grew steadily smaller. The horse stood still, only shivering from time to time.
"Summer, summer, summer," sang Vasya.
The sun shone warm again, and the rain had stopped long enough to give the barley a chance. Measuring herself against the horse, Vasya found she had grown even taller over the winter.
"Well," she thought ruefully, "we can't all be small as Irina."
Tiny Irina was already hailed as a beauty. Vasya tried not to think of it. Mish broke into the girl's reverie.
"We would like to offer you a gift," she said.
She put down her head to nibble at the new grass. Vasya's hands faltered.
"A gift?
You brought us bread this winter. We are in your debt."
"Us?
But the Vasila is all of us together," replied the mayor. "Something more as well, but mostly he is us."
"Oh," said Vasya perplexed. "Well, I thank you."
"Best not be grateful for the grass until you've eaten it," the mayor said with a snort. "Our gift is this. We wish to teach you to ride."
This time Vasya really did freeze, except the blood came rushing into her heart. She could ride on a fat gray pony she shared with Irina. But
truly? She whispered.
"Yes," said the mayor, "though it may prove a mixed blessing. Such a gift could drive you apart from your people."
"My people," said Vasya, very low. "They wept before the icons while the Domovoy starved. I do not know them. They have changed, and I have not." Aloud, she said, "I am not afraid."
"Good," said the mayor. "We shall begin when the mud dries."
Vasya half forgot the mayor's promise in the weeks that followed. Spring meant weeks of numbing labor, and at each day's close, Vasya ate the poor bread from the previous year's barley, with soft white cheese and tender new herbs, then flung herself onto the oven and slept like a child. But suddenly it was May, and the mud disappeared under new grass. Dandelions shone like stars amid the deep green. The horses threw long shadows, and the sickle moon stood alone in the sky. On the day that Vasya, sweating, scratched, and exhausted, stopped in the horse pasture on her way back from the barley field.
"Come here," said Mish. "Get on my back."
Vasya was almost too tired to reply. She gazed stupidly at the horse and said,
"I've no saddle."
Mish snorted.
"Nor will you. You must learn to manage without. I will carry you, but I am not your servant."
Vasya met the mayor's eye. A flicker of humor showed in the brown depths.
"Does your leg not pain you?" she asked,
feebly, nodding at the half-healed gash on the mayor's flank.
"No," Mish replied. "Mount."
Vasya thought of her hot supper, of her stool by the oven. Then she gritted her teeth, backed up, ran, and flung herself belly down onto the mayor's back. A bit of squirming, and Vasya settled herself uncomfortably just behind the hard withers. The mare's ears eased back at the scrabbling.
"You will need practice."
Vasya could never remember where they went that day. They rode, of necessity, deep in the woods. But the riding was painful. That Vasya always remembered. They jogged along until Vasya's back and legs trembled.
"Be still," said the mayor. "It is as if there are three of you instead of one."
Vasya tried, slipping this way and that. At last, exasperated, Mish pulled up sharply. Vasya rolled over the mayor's shoulder and landed, blinking, on the loamy forest floor.
"Get up," said the horse. "Be more careful."
When they returned to the pasture, Vasya was filthy, bruised, and certain that walking was beyond her. She had also missed her supper and earned a scolding. But the next evening, she did it again, and again. It was not always with Mish. The horses took turns teaching her to ride. She could not go every day. In spring, she worked incessantly, they all did, to put the crops in the earth. But Vasya went often enough, and slowly her back and thighs and stomach began to hurt less. Finally, the day came when they did not hurt at all. And in the meantime, she learned to keep her balance, to vault to a horse's back, to spin and start and stop and leap, until she could no longer tell where the horse ended and she began. The sky seemed bigger that midsummer, clouds scudding across it like swans. The barley rippled green in the fields, though it was stunted, and Pyotr shook his head over it. Vasya, her basket over her arm, disappeared into the forest every day. Dunya would sometimes look askance at the girl's offerings, birch bark mostly, or buckthorn for making dye, and rarely in sufficient quantities. However, Vasya was golden and shining with happiness, so Dunya just harumphed and said nothing. But all the while, the heat deepened until it was honey thick, too hot. For all the people's prayers, fires broke out in the tinder dry forest, and the barley grew but slowly. A white hot day in August saw Vasya making her way to the lake, trying not to limp. Buran had taken Vasya riding. The gray stallion, white now, was still the biggest of the riding horses, and he had the wickedest sense of humor. Vasya had bruises to prove it. The lake dazzled in the sunlight. As Vasya drew nearer, she thought she heard rustling in the trees that fringed the water. But when she looked up, she saw no flash of green skin. After a few moments' fruitless search, Vasya gave up, stripped, and slid into the lake. The water was purest snow melt, cold even at midsummer. It drove the air from her lungs, and Vasya bit back a yelp. She dove at once, the icy water startling life from her weary limbs. She cavorted about underwater, peering here and there. But there was no Rusalka. Vaguely uneasy, Vasya paddled to the bank, pulled her clothes into the water, and pounded them clean on rocks. Finally, she hung them dripping on a nearby limb and climbed the tree herself, stretching cat-like along a branch to dry in the sun. Perhaps an hour later, Vasya roused herself from an exhausted stupor and eyed her half-dry clothes. The sun had passed its zenith and begun to tilt west, which meant, in the long days of midsummer, that the afternoon was well advanced. By now, Anna would be seething, and even Dunya would give her a tight-lipped glare when she slunk in the door. Irina was no doubt crouched over the sweltering oven or wearing out her fingers with mending. Feeling guilty, Vasya crept down to a lower limb and froze. Father Constantine was sitting in the grass. He might have been a handsome farmer and not a priest at all. He had traded his robe for a linen shirt and loose trousers, studded with bits of barley stem, and his uncovered hair blazed in the afternoon sun. He was looking out at the lake. "What is he doing here?" Vasya was still screened by the tree's foliage. She hooked her knees around the branch, let herself down, and snatched her clothes, quick as a squirrel. Perching awkwardly on an upper limb, trying not to fall and break an arm, she slipped into her shirt and leggings, stolen from Alyosha, and used her fingers to wrestle some order into her hair. Finally, she flicked the end of a lumpy braid behind her, caught the tree limb, and swung to the ground. "Maybe if I creep away very quietly." Then Vasya saw the Rusalka. She was standing in the water. Her hair floated around her, half masking her bare breasts. She smiled, just a little, at Father Constantine. The priest, entranced, stood up and swayed toward her. Without thinking, Vasya darted at him and caught his hand, but he shoved her off almost casually, stronger than he looked. Vasya turned to the Rusalka.
Leave him alone!
He will kill us all, the Rusalka replied, voice soft, eyes never leaving her prey. Already it has begun. If he goes on as he has, all the guardians of the deep forest will disappear. The storm will come, and the land will go undefended. Have you not seen it? Fear is first, then fire, then famine. He made your people afraid, and then the fires burned, and now the sun scorches. You will be hungry when the cold comes. The Winter King is weak, and his brother very near. He will come if the wards fail. Better anything than that. Her voice shook with passion. Better I take this one now. Father Constantine took another step. The water welled up around his boots. He was on the very brink of the lake. Vasya shook her head, trying to clear it.
You must not.
Why not? Is his life worth everyone else's? And I say to you surely that if he lives now, many will die. Vasya hesitated a long moment. She remembered unwillingly the priest praying beside Timofey's stiffening corpse, mouthing the words long after his voice had gone. She remembered him holding the boy's mother upright when she would have fallen weeping to the snow. The girl set her teeth and shook her head. The Rusalka threw back her head and shrieked, and then she wasn't there at all. There was only sun on the water, weeds, and tree shadows. Vasya caught the priest's hand and yanked him away from the edge. He looked down at her, and awareness came back to his eyes. Constantine's feet were cold, and he felt strangely bereft. Cold because he was standing in 6 inches of water on the very brink of the lake, but he wondered at the stab of loneliness. He never felt lonely. A face was swimming into focus. Before he could put a name to it, the person caught his hand and dragged him stumbling back to dry land. The light glanced red off the black braid, and suddenly he knew her. Vasilisa Petrovna. She dropped his hand and turned and looked at him. Batyushka. He felt his wet feet, remembered the woman in the lake, and felt the beginnings of fear.
What are you doing? He demanded.
Saving your life, she replied. The lake is a danger to you.
Demons.
Vasya shrugged. Or the guardian of the lake. Call her what you will. He made as though to turn back to the water, fumbling at his cross with one hand. She reached forward and seized it, breaking the thong that held it around his neck.
Leave it! And her!
The girl said fiercely, holding the cross out of reach.
You've done enough damage. Can you not let them be? I want to save you, Vasilisa Petrovna, he said. I will save you all. There are dark forces that you do not understand.
To his surprise, and perhaps to hers, she laughed. Amusement smoothed the angles of her face. Caught, he stared at her in unwilling admiration.
It seems to me, Batyushka, that it is you who do not understand, as it was your life that needed saving. Go back to the work in the barley fields and leave the lake alone.
She turned without waiting to see if he followed, feet noiseless on the moss and pine needles. Constantine fell in beside her. She still held his wooden cross between her two fingers.
Vasilisa Petrovna, he tried again, cursing his clumsiness.
Always he knew what to say. But this girl turned her clear gaze on him, and all his certainty grew vague and foolish.
You must leave your barbaric ways. You must return to God in fear and true repentance. You are the daughter of a good Christian lord.
Your mother will run mad if we do not exorcise the demons from her hearth. Vasilisa Petrovna, turn! Repent!
I go to church, father, she replied. Anna Ivanovna is not my mother, nor is her madness my business, just as my soul is not yours. And it seems to me we did very well before you came, for if we prayed less, we also wept less.
She had walked swiftly. Through the tree trunks, he could see the palisade of the village.
Mark me, Batyushka, she said. Pray for the dead, comfort the sick, and comfort my stepmother. But leave me alone, or next time one of them comes for you, I shall not lift a finger to stop it.
She did not wait for a reply, but thrust his cross back into his hand and strode off toward the village. It was warm from her hand, and his fingers curled reluctantly around it.